8th of December 1995, morning class, Srimad Bhagavatam class, given by Shri Krishnapad of Giranagri.
Bhagavati Uttama Sloke Bhakti Bhavati Naistati Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
So, I hear you started the day before yesterday, chapter 1, text number 1, and it seems like you got into 3 paragraphs of that. So we've had the chant before. It's rather long. It's about a 5-page purport. So we'll just continue what you've read. I'll just read the purport and then a few of the paragraphs. And I guess we have to continue this for a couple of days. That's about five pages. I just want an announcement. I'll be leaving here tomorrow. And I'll be back in about 2 weeks to visit a few different temples. And when I come back, if possible, some devotees would like to meet with me individually or about ideas they have. I'd be most excited to meet with the different devotees. When I come back, I'll be here for up until the new year. And then short time after, a few more travels. And then I'll go south to India. Yeah, there's 2 announcements on the board. Hopefully some of you have seen. 1 announcement about standards, and then announcements, and then a sign-up list for devotees who would like to give a particular workshop. In fact, I have a good copy here. Move real fast. Some of the areas to begin to enumerate, and you have some other areas that you would like to share something in, or you would like to see somebody else give some discussion about such. Please be sure to write it in. Just put a few here. And this doesn't have to be some very sophisticated presentation, but someone sharing some knowledge they have, or an area that you are particularly interested in that you may not have present knowledge of, but you can do some research and then offer the essentials in such a way. Bartering, clothes, manufacturing, gardening, farming, so it's on the board. These, one of these areas is something you would like to in the future give some discussion on in the evening, share with the devotees, then you know try to sign in, then later we can start scheduling who can give what. We'll start with our own inner situation first, and then at a later time we can invite other people also, and those in the immediate communities around as well as some other places of the temples to come in to share. Bartering, clothes and manufacturing, gardening and farming, food storage, processing and preservation, cooking class, water purification supply, computer literacy, carpentry, masonry, crop protection, parenting, child care, teaching skills, editing and writing, health care, fundraising, defense and security, deity services, sankirtan and preaching strategies, music, content services, alternative energy, and others. So that was just a list to get us started. But if something, one of those items, something that you can offer some little points of edification, clarification, information, then start signing up if you can. Then we'll see what we have, and hopefully we can start even this Monday. Maybe Kadamisha, you can start off speaking about bartering, sharing some things about bartering. Normally the community building classes were at 7 o'clock or 6 o'clock? 7?
6:30.
6:30. 6:30. Is that right after the RT?
Yes.
Kadavisha, maybe you can start by sharing the points in body, huh? I'll just make the refresh our minds with the purport, with the translation, rather, and then a few paragraphs in the purport. This is Canto 1, Chapter 1, Questions by the Sages. O my Lord Sri Krishna, son of Vasudev, all-pervading personality of Godhead, offer my respectful obeisances unto you. I meditate upon Lord Sri Krishna because he is the absolute truth. Just one point before I read this again. The list also is not just for developing some skills, but you can see it's kind of concomitant with trying to increase our connection with our services here, our day-to-day ongoing services, because some of the things are directly related to that, but some things are more kind of looking more toward development for future. But both things, of course, are there. It's like a computer literacy. So these are some things we can try to know something about now and use now in some of our services. Classes, do some things. Some, what if they want to share some points about dressing or some other concerns about deity service that can be helpful to the community. So these are see the immediate things. And the other areas of exploration deal more with setting a foundation for greater developments in the future, like alternative energy sources and things like that. Oh my Lord Sri Krishna, son of Vasudev, O all-pervading personality of Godhead, I offer my respectful obeisance unto you. I meditate upon Lord Sri Krishna because he is the absolute truth, the primeval cause of all causes of creation, substance and destruction of the manifested universes. He is directly and indirectly conscious of all manifestations. And he is independent because there is no other cause beyond him. It is he who first imparted the Vedic knowledge unto the heart of Brahmaji, the original living being. By him, even the great sages and demigods are placed into illusion. As one is bewildered by the illusory representations of water seen in fire or land seen on water. Only because of him do the material universe is temporarily manifest by the reaction of the three modes of nature appear factual, although they are unreal. I therefore meditate upon him, Lord Sri Krishna, who is eternally existent in the transcendental abode, who is forever free from the illusion, the illusory representations of the material world. I meditate upon him, for he is the absolute truth. This scares the materialists and the academician, scientists. When they hear absolute anything, merely the science or dogma. I was having a TV program in one country, and there was some sort of spiritual, he was a metaphysician. Actually, he was head of the Baha'i faith for that particular country. And he was also a scientist, a psychiatrist as well. Quite endowed gentleman. And so it was interesting seeing how he was schizoid. Because in one sense, he was trying to be a spiritually thinking-minded person, accepting that there is spiritual life and there are principles that one is to follow in spiritual life. There are techniques and what have you. But on the other side, because of his so-called scientific thinking and basically relating to things based on a reductionistic, materialistic paradigm, so he could speak some things about spiritual life and even felt that he was accepting that there is a God. But then he was vehement that there is no absolute truth. There can be no such thing as absolute truth. And his conception was, that is why, Param Brahma, that is why scientific people, intelligent people, do not want to accept theism, because of this thrust about absolute truth. So there he was, in one sense, projecting himself as a spiritualist, as a theist, leader of an organization that's based on some spiritual principles. But at the same time, he was attacking the basic ground of what his or any so-called spiritual organization is supposed to be about. Because of his feeling intimidated by things that are not relevant. Because to one extent, when you commit yourself to something, you're considered no longer to be legitimate. Because once you commit, you're no longer objective. You committed to something, now you've given up your objective appraisal, evaluation, and you are a follower. You are subjectively a part of something that you're just kind of, you know, forcing yourself to accept because you've accepted a certain pattern, now you're fitting everything into that. So therefore, they consider the valuable thing to do is not to commit to anything, study things, observe them, compare, evaluate historically, you know, evaluate sociologically, anthropologically, but don't accept anything, don't lock yourself into anything, because once you do that, you're counted out, because now you're one of those practitioners. This is a sad situation, because anyone who hasn't found something very, very intense to commit their life to live, to give their life for, to live their life for, then such person hasn't really begun to live. And most people like that. They haven't found anything yet. And so what do? They just explore one type of sense gratification after another, experiencing some temporary stimulation, until they get bored with that, frustrated, and they try something else. And then after a while, they get more and more into perversions, because even the general things, the normal things, so-called, become a fry to them. And so they're looking for the adventure. But we're not in any way disturbed by commitment. Matter of fact, we understand that it's important to do some things with intensity so that there is intense results. Otherwise, everything becomes, on the outside, looking in. Or just a matter of speculation, interpolation, etc. So, you can see the absurdity. If you say that there's no absolute truth, then you're really saying that there's no God. Because if you say there's no absolute truth, then there is no power or no being of any absolute nature. If there is an entity of absolute consideration, an entity has full ability to arrange and to provide absolute principles of how he can be absolutely known and appreciated. And if such entity does not exist, then everything is based on certain relevant considerations based on what is comfortable or functional for a given time according to different groupings of people. Then you get a whole mishmash of just secondary considerations. But because the wild minds want to engage us in the mental gymnastics, and the idea of really logging in, of really locking themselves in, is not at all what they're ready to do. Which means the whole idea of surrender is completely out of their consciousness. They want to know something to be able to conquer over it. They want to know something to be able to show how they have a leverage over someone else. They want to understand something. You see, in the basic Darwin pattern of conquering over nature, of mastering over what Krishna has provided. And of course, such people are the ones who are frustrated, because what can they really master over? Death is there, even before that, disease, and of course, Adi David, Adi Bhotik, so many different miseries that are ongoing that they have to experience. So, when we present the idea of absolute truthisms, then of course it must be gentle, because it automatically causes people's buttons to be pushed. Because they don't want to know that there is something that every entity, every living being, there are certain requirements of every living being. They don't want to explore what human life really is about. Because an animalistic platform. And by being an animalistic platform, their concerns are just about eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. It's just all survival issues. And they have trouble dealing with that, so thinking beyond that is difficult. They don't have the time or the energy or the desire. They can barely think enough about how to improve on those things. But because we preach it, there is a Saman Bona, then we're trying to find out, oh, now, what is the dictates, what is the desires of such supreme personality? And we know that if we're able to accommodate those desires, then the more we perfect what this existence is about. Otherwise, we just enhance the material glamour and cosmeticness. Prabhupada writes, it is natural that a philosophical mind wants to know about the origin of the creation. At night he sees the stars in the sky. Does it seem like we read this before? Anybody remember this? We read this? No, I mean in the class. Such inquiries are natural for man. Man has developed a conscience which is higher than that of the animals. Man should develop a conscience, or can develop a conscience. But if our activities are still on an animalistic platform, we're in a human body, but we're in an animalistic conscience. We haven't gone to the mode of goodness, we're in animalistic conscience. And even to the point, with what he was asking to the Prabhupada about chanting rounds, so we're not being able to chant the rounds. The Prabhupada says, he's an animal. That if one is not chanting 16 rounds, then it's a very heavy statement on the Prabhupada's own words. Meaning that such consciousness and such ultimate desires of such persons who are not calling on the Lord, then they're in a human form, but the consciousness is just gross. Consciousness is based on the survival issues. At night, the author of Srimad Bhagavatam gives a direct answer to such inquiries. He says that Lord Sri Krishna is the origin of all creations. He is not only the creator of the universe, but the destroyer as well. The manifested cosmic nature is created at a certain period by the will of the Lord. Therefore, the supreme will is behind all cosmic activities. Behind all, so absolutely. Of course, there are atheists of various categories who do not believe in a creator. But that is due to, Prabhupada says, a poor fund of knowledge. The modern scientist, for example, has created space satellites. By some arrangement or other, these satellites are thrown into outer space to fly for some time at the control of the scientists, who are far away. Similarly, all the universes with innumerable stars and planets are controlled by the intelligence of the personality of Godhead. Not so long ago, the astronomers found another planet within this universe. And as there's discussions in exobiology that there are life-like molecules and literally millions of other universes. So that means that now we understand that there's some life, different life forms here. And even on this one planet, you see so many different types of forms, so many types of bodies, so many races, so many different tribes. They look so different. Size difference, features different. Even here on this one planet, this small planet. So from here we can understand the variegatedness of the human species. And the 8,400,000 species, it's not that they're all here in this particular planet, but they are within the whole of material creation the soul can enter into. Just before coming here, I was doing some also TV filming. I do lots and lots of TV programs different places. So one of the host of a special program we have in Africa and Ghana happened to be in America. He was visiting President Carter, was holding some conference, ex-President Carter. And so he was one of the international guests invited. So while he was in town, he came to visit us in Maryland, because I do a lot of programs on their television show in the country. And he decided that while he was here, he wanted to film one or two TV programs and then just send them and to play them on television. And so it's important for us there because There's only one TV station in the whole of Ghana. So whoever has television, they're going to watch it. It's kind of dangerous because it establishes a certain mindset amongst the people. Most people are into whatever the newspaper on TV, they take as absolute truth. It's their authorities. But then good in the sense that a chance to reach many people at, little energy. So one of the programs he wanted to do was on UFOs and extraterrestrials. And I had a chance to share some contemporary things and as well as ancient. Now one of the things we're discussing, Prabhupada is talking about satellites and what have you, there is a tremendous exposures going on now. Here in America and in so many other countries, I'm just showing how there's been such a amazing cover-up and visitations that have been going on this planet. Now we know since the time of Lord Buddha that there was a stoppage of so much vivid traffic. Traffic never stops. There's always all types of activities going on in this particular regime or region. Because the Earth makes planet is very special. Medium planet, and it's a place where entities are coming from the lower regions, coming from the middle regions, coming from the higher regions. It is always an environment of fights going on between the asuras and the suras, between the demons and the devas. It's always a place where there is a fighting going on for the minds of the people, and the people in general are just products of the activities. And sometimes the inauspicious forces seem to be more dominant. Just like they are, what Prabhupada refers to as the rakshasas. So many of these rakshasas, they're like tyrants. And they involve themselves in all types of ritualistic activities. Just like the yogis, the Brahmins involve themselves in activities for purification. And we see a case like Ravana, Jarasandha. They were also astute in some of their practices. And their austerities and their yogis, rituals. But they were always thinking how to destroy the absolute truth. They're always thinking how to defame, how to eradicate, create an environment where people would just want to engage in all kind of relative sense gratification activities, and for that to be established as the rule of law. So some of these tyrants, These are people in physical bodies. Some of them are heavy, heavy, heavy demonically possessed. And they have so much help. Some of them, they engage in these kind of rituals that invoke all sort of powers and associations with lower entities. And some of these entities are of extraterrestrial nature. Just like we see that they are... In all different traditions, there are so much discussions about angels and archangels and what have you. And we see that as we read the scriptures closely, we understand that according to consciousness, one can be able to be in tune to so many life forms. That the pure devotees of the Lord, they are always in association with so many aspects of Krishna's creation. Because there's no hunger or false ego for them. And so such coverings that normally obfuscate the view and connection for the conditioned souls is not prevailing for such beings. But these great spiritual personalities, they bypass all of this activity and Marcha Loka and such planets, any other material planets. It means nothing, very little to them. It's just all places of misery, places of suffering. This is all places where there's still disease and old age and also death. But now many people becoming fascinated because they're realizing that these visitations are real. They're realizing that in all folklore traditions there's information about such. In all religious scriptures there's information about such. All scriptures that have some sense of history. And then they're seeing that there's somehow seemingly more and more sightings. And what is really scaring them is that there's so many abductions. One of my devotees works with the American Psychological Association. And so the other day she dropped by and dropped me a book over. And it's things I knew about, but I was shocked to see how much this kind of information is becoming a part of the Orthodox, you know, communities. And the book was about a psychiatrist in Harvard who teaches it at Harvard, teaches psychiatry, and is a leading author and researcher, has written a book mentioning how hundreds of thousands and perhaps millions of people in America seemingly have been abducted by aliens. Mm-hmm. Pretty heavy thing. Now he has been interviewing so many people who are experiencing various types of sometimes problems, neurosis, psychosis, whatever, from some of the experiences that they report based on the abductions. And here he is, one of the so-called better schools of America, in one of the so-called respected professions. You become a doctor first, and you grant up in psychiatry, and teaching psychiatry. And he's writing this bold book mentioning how, after interviewing hundreds and hundreds of people who are so-called abductees, that he's totally convinced, and gives other scientists appraisal, that people are being are interacting with extraterrestrial beings and are being abducted and having various things happen to them. Now, this is not necessarily a discussion for Bhagavatam class, but one thing interesting, relevant for us in our growth and investigation, is one of the most dominant things that is constantly reported with these abductions is that the entities are telling those who be abducted that the Earth planet is, if you keep leaning, then you can go to sleep. That the Earth planet is very sick, that so many ecological disasters are happening and will increase like anything, and that millions of people will die, and that wars will increase. And they're telling that not only will it have such an effect on, of course, our immediate existence, but in other aspects of the galaxy as well. So they are talking to these people as they abduct them, and one of the major things that's happening in the transmission is that they're telling these people about how to be more caring about what has been provided by God, and how to become freer and freer of violence, of lust, and of greed that will inevitably bring more and more destruction. So this is like one of the most consistent things that's going on when such people are abducted, with all the other things that's happening to them. As we mentioned yesterday, I'm just giving some reference on some other areas, but in so many situations, there is more and more discussions and appraisal about the precarious dangers that that Mother Bhumi is experiencing and is to experience. Now, it doesn't take a great scientist or a great mystic or psychic or whatever to evaluate some of these things, because the future is really nothing more in one sense than an extension of the present. It's like we understand that our present has much to do with our karma from the past, what we did and how we're thinking. So our future, our near future and our far future, is nothing more than a unfoldment based on what we're thinking and what we're doing now. If you look at basically what people are thinking and what they're doing now, and then you can see and figure out what kind of collective situations or mass situations that it will produce. But the amazing thing, of course, is how even with such knowledge that's beginning to leak out more and more, because there have been so many cover-ups. And a major cover-up has come out now in 1948 in New Mexico. There was not only sighting of UFOs, extraterrestrials, but it was over 100 people who would, in the United States military were aware of such. And there was actual crash where they not only part of the craft, but there were bodies that were found. Three or four bodies of aliens. The kind of people reporting seeing so much, the little short guys with the big eyes and the big ears. So, initially it came out in the newspaper. And then, based on input from CIA and other agencies, then they counteracted that and said, oh no, it was considered that, but it was just a weather balloon. But some years back, and now discussions are happening this year, and some of the people who have retired now have begun to report that it did happen and their jobs were threatened if they gave information about such. And there was like, you know, massively silenced. And so some of those people I've been speaking of in national media addressing such issues. So, advantage of such, if people take notice, is that if they consider such things more seriously than they can consider, then what is really telling us about the greater aspect of life itself? And what is this telling us about our normal myopic consciousness of how we normally think life is nothing more than what we can immediately enjoy and that there is certainly no consequence? Or what is this telling us about our real sense of heritage as entities who are just occupying these physical bodies at this temporary time? And what is this saying about the cheatingness of our leaders? Because some years back when President Carter was running for office, he had mentioned in his campaign at least two or three times that if he was elected, he would force the government to expose information that it has about these kind of things. So once he was elected, then of course, yeah, it was business as usual. Because it's just not the kind of things that is so much being made available, of course, to common people. But obviously, where there's power, where there's manipulations, where there is so much propaganda, then everything is based on what the sinful people who are in charge, what their particular agendas are. And it's those entities who have such trouble with the idea that there is some higher power, some higher being, and that there is situations that we're all accountable for. So if they look at this closely, then they realize how the divinity is transverse. Manya Konya Bhagavandiya Guru Krishna Prasadi Paya Bhakti Nara Bija. How we're going, huh? Lifetime after lifetime. And what is the purpose? Just to live in this planet, this body, that body. Now, is that really what life is all about? Just changing suits, changing environments, just for those environments later to have various types of complexities. But it's about something greater than that. And they investigate closely, then they'll come to a greater appreciation of what it is. Why are we being thrusted into these bodies? Why is there such temporariness to such? Because all these planets and universes are nothing more than different arrangements, different abodes, where living entities are trying to run away from accepting the position of the absolute truth. But all these environments are just just atmospheres where people are like engaged in different types of toys, pursuing different things to master, where they can try to do as much as possible, consider as much as possible, but don't bring in the idea of Supreme God, who has supreme arrangements for everyone. And this same Supreme Lord, what does he do? We see that he allows for the creation of these planets and universes, for the maintenance, and also for the annihilation. And when such things are annihilated, either temporary or total annihilation, then there is distinct reasons for such, based on the activity of the proper citizens of those particular environments. So for devotees, we always know that the material body and material universes are always in disarray, and that things are coming and going and transitions are taking place. We always know that there are yogis and there are entities that have the control of prana or consciousness where they can visit other abodes. But we are not interested in just being tourists in this material world or in other material universes, because they are all places of ultimate places of misery and death. So whether we are just focusing on the relativeness of this planet or the relativeness of other planets and universes, it's all transitory and leads into a certain amount of frustration. But as we try to think more about if there is a Supreme Personality of Godhead, and what does He want, or what does He arrange, what is His absolute position, and what is our position based on that, trying to be the proper servants, then all becomes auspicious by such. Hare Krishna. Any questions or any comments? Yes.
Lord, a lot of time we'll find like pious people that are born in a rich family, they'll keep on engaging in pious activities and they're basically pious and they stay in this sort of this line and they're born again in such a situation. For these people, how is the best way to give them Krishna consciousness, like preaching or whatever you're speaking to them? How can you best approach that type of people?
If someone is pious, then it means that they are already in a position of being candidates to receive higher. That means they have some good considerations about humanity. They have some type of reverence and appreciation for God. And now it's a matter of trying to entice them, enhance them, convince them, encourage them to make the next step. When you get somebody to make a step forward, there has to be some communication and some connection and some relevancy. So if you're trying to get people to do something and they don't feel that it's relevant for them, then what happens? They back out of it. They play out of it. They avoid it. So as we're preaching to pious people, it should be easier for us to help them to see the relevancy, because they're making steps that are auspicious. Now, once we preach and we try to share with them by connecting where they're at and then trying to bring them up, sometimes they become disturbed. Why? Because some people are pious, but that's all that they're ready to deal with in this lifetime. They're not ready to go beyond that. And some people are pious and they're stuck there because they just haven't had other exposure. And when they're not envious of Krishna, when they have a sense of humility and some appreciation of what can be now available as they hear Bhakti Ras, then there can be some change in such people's lives. Our duty is to offer, to be as tactful and palatable as possible, to offer, then the result is up to Krishna based in that individual. In terms of how that person responds when they have contact with Krishna consciousness. We can't be too disturbed about the results, because that becomes attachment also. But our disturbance would be to see that we can share as best as possible. See, in one sense, we're not really making devotees by preaching. There are souls who have the karma, the sukriti, that once the transcendental vibration is out and they have contact with it, it will stimulate them and they will make some connection. They will make a change. But if we don't put out the effort in trying to send out the message, then there are souls who will not be woken, because they will not hear the sound vibration of Krishna Tattva. So the pious, then, it means that they have some credits. It's there, they've been accumulated. And we want to try to see what we can do as a catalyst to now let them make those credits more mature by connecting them with transcendental understanding. Yes. I didn't say there's no reason. I said it's not important or it's not a priority. Devotee can learn about anything. This can be used and help with preaching or help that person in unfoldment. But we understand that over endeavor in such things with mundane considerations will produce vinashti, will produce falling. If somebody is just trying to learn things, whether it's material or even so-called spiritual, they're trying to learn just so much for the sake of learning, for the mind to be satisfied and for the intellect to be satisfied, then that can cause some falling. Because then there'll just be the intenseness about just trying to know, to know, to know, to know. But the point is to knowledge is to be imbibed, to produce something, to act upon something, to use it in some way. So what to say if it's material or mystical or psychic, there is so much emphasis in trying to know such things. Then it becomes another expression of sense gratification. Maybe subtle sense gratification, but it's an expression of sense gratification. Now, if in the effort of preaching or trying to understand more in relationship to Krishna's wonderfulness, to help us in our devotion, or to even act as catalysts for bridge to help with the communication, then such things becomes a part of sankirtan or can be used in such ways to engender a higher connection. But if we're just trying to learn material things and metaphysical things and taking it as the all in all, then there's a problem. Just like when we're talking about our children, right? So we want our children to know things and have some basic understandings. Because if they don't have some basic understandings, then what they are learning spiritually, it will not be relevant. There'll be something that's in the ethers. But if they're knowing basic things and they're taught with a spiritual reference, then as they're understanding and they're integrating the spiritual, it's all having meaning to them, as they're growing and unfolding. Otherwise, it will just be a matter of being force-fed something that's not really registering. It's almost like sometimes if you're just learning something by rote, by memory. Because some people's memories are just very good in general. But sometimes you're learning something by memory and you're not really into it. You don't really understand the connection. It doesn't have any relevance to you. Then after a while, even though you've learned it, but then you'll forget about it later. Because it doesn't really connect. It's something you just kind of, allow the mind to attach itself to for a while. And then you forget all this stuff. So we're not just wanting to just learn things just for the sake of learning. Or we want the other extreme. Just thinking that because our movement is a preaching movement. And so we don't think that, I'll just chant Hare Krishna and that's it. But who's advanced enough, they can just chant and then be okay with that. We have to be able to remind and understand why we're chanting. And to appreciate why it's important, why we're doing these things. And then as we chant and do other things, then we access a deeper connection from those. The more that one has knowledge about what he or she is doing in terms of the spiritual activity, then the more that is potent. Even if you don't have knowledge about it, but if you just do it, some potency is there. But the more you have understanding about it, the more potent it is.
Yes, Srila Prabhupada and Bhagavad Gita said that one become a devotee or a pure devotee, that it helps his generation of 100 years forward and 100 years back.
That's some places referred to as 100 or 10 generations.
10 generations.
Of liberation.
Mm-hmm. How will it help those generation back? I guess I think I can understand how it helped the generation forward, but how did it help the past generation?
Are they really gone? They're somewhere hanging out. Still around. And just like many of our parents, many of the bodies, they're going to be shocked. Because they'll have a realization who their daughter or son, what their son or daughter was involved in. And they'll be shocked. Because they'll have to deal with the fact that they had some serious opportunity to benefit seriously in this lifetime from having Sadhu in their family. You know, but they didn't. But still, if we go on with our devotion, it becomes more and more of pure nature. They will benefit from it. That's why it's so important for a devotee to be serious, because a devotee is always dealing with much more than just themselves. So those aggregate entities that are there within your universe, like the body is a universe itself. You know, there's so much different aspects of life. It's an exaggeration, but you know, but we are just some aspect, you know. And sometimes some of the things that's happening is based on what's happening to the earth. That it's reaching certain levels, certain thresholds, etc. So within our body is so many different entities that are being affected by whatever ourself, the dominant soul there, is in consciousness with that is doing. Now we're affecting so many entities, souls who are connected with us karmically, based on what we do. We just look at our immediate families, for instance. Basically, we go around the room, we go around temples, we go around countries, we'll find that most of our relatives are on their way to hell. I mean, honestly, if you think about it, they're eating meat, taking intoxications, doing all kinds of things. In some cases, they're even being blasphemous towards the devotees. They're angry at Krishna. They're envious at Krishna. Some cases, they're very envious at Krishna, thinking, Krishna has taken my son and daughter away. My son and daughter, all they do is give their service and love to Krishna. They're angry. So, they're in bad shape. But their help, saving grace, is somehow or other, there is a Vaishnava in their family. And that is something rare. And they will be helped. They'll be helped by that. And if we become pure, then we get some type of liberation. But they will be helped. Despite the fact that there is devotee in the family, they will be helped. There's some nice cases, and if one or two of them was written in the Vyasa Pooja book, in the Jamuna Swami, or was it Sivaram Swami, that mentioned the case of his mother. I think somebody read that? For the Sivaram, in the Jamuna? He mentions how his mother, you know, she was, she got very sick and she left her body. But before she left, how she started reading the books, and she, I forgot the exact words, but she mentioned how, before she left the body, that she wasn't worried because she's not the body, she understood that the soul was eternal. So this was distinct blessings that were carried over based on the fact that her son was a devotee. So Krishna, you know, reciprocated. And there's many cases like that where devotees are finding that some unusual thing is happening, that some relatives have become interested or become serious and taking advantage of Krishna consciousness. It's even beyond their understanding. So sometimes it's happening even before us in this lifetime. I was just, when I was visiting Chicago, I was with Radha Swami and Chandramodi Swami, some of the other devotees. And Radha Swami was just mentioning to me how his parents, you know, used to be so inimical in so many ways. And then, just late now in their later part of their life, they went to visit him in India, and now they completely changed. And they just tell, father just tells all of his relatives, his friends and everything, well, I have a son, you know, he's a missionary, he travels around the world, he does that, and he's so proud of him. So sometimes there's shifts that happen as we just go on and we just treat them. You know, I sent some messages last year to all of the temples around the world and the leaders, emphasizing that as we're trying to save the world, that we should be also more attentive to trying to give some mercy to those who help bring us and brought us into the world. And I was mentioning how our greatest legal cases and greatest attackers, we have to look at the movement being attacked, our greatest attackers are parents of the movement. And in so many of those cases, the attacks could have been avoided if we would have kept some communication. In some cases, you know, it's going to be that way anyway. It's going to be inimical regardless. But in some cases, if we would have kept some level of communication, or if we would have had some ways to expose them a little more to what is going on, that some people wouldn't have went on campaigns. They still may have been disturbed. But they really get more and more furious and think, now my son and daughter, they have left me, they're gone, especially if they're young, and they have no, they're not writing me, they're not calling me. I saw them once and they said that I was going to go to hell, I'm a demon, you know. And then they just, you know, become furious. Now they become furious, and then who do they tell? They speak like anything. Their friends, they speak to other relatives. And most people will consider your parents authorities on you. Huh? So they start saying all of this, then you have some other people who become inimical toward the movement. And they hurt their spiritual life by such. So I wrote proposals sending to the leaders that we should have cases where possible, where there's a parent who's very favorable, get that parent in corresponding with other parents. This is especially at temples when you have a lot of new devotees joining. Most of us are old timers, things are already set. But especially with the new devotees, especially. Because see, now even devotees are joining, and the temple president is older than the person who's joined mother or father sometimes. And so then they can feel a little bit more comfortable if you invite them and talk to them and let them know that you're going to tell them your best to take care of their child, even if the child is involved in. But also invite them and let other parents write them or talk to them. Or, I mentioned about holding, you know, from time to time, just parent nights, where you invite the parents, and you have some of the parents who are more favorable, or some of the devotees, all the devotees speak, and discuss things with them. Let them feel a little more comfortable what they're doing, what their child is in. They still, you know, some become favorable, very favorable, but others, at least they will not feel so antagonistic. They will not be so resentful. And I encourage my devotees in many places to, you know, write. Even if your parents are inimical, at least send them a letter every now and then. Let them know that you're alive and that you are happy or you are struggling. And so that they will, you know, not have such bad will. And some of them can make some shifts, you know, based on that. Now it stops me. It will stop many of our legal problems, some of our greatest legal problems. It will also help us to give more care to some of those who we owe some dues to. If we weren't devotees, we would definitely owe dues to the demigods, to our forefathers. And it is there. We owe them something. But now, we pay them off, of course, by our devotion. But how much more we can assist them if we can make them at least neutral? So they're not antagonistic. Some cases happening with some of the devotees now because, you know, when a devotee gets a little older and they marry, and they go and visit their families, and even though they may not be so favorable, but you know, the typical thing is once they see the grandkids, they think, well, it can't be so bad. Because he's kind of got a nice wife also. Maybe they're not completely crazy. You know? And after all, they're a little happy. And then later they say, you know, I'm so glad you joined this Krishna movement, because you look at the other brother and sister, he's an alcoholic, drug addict, been, you know, in this problem, that problem. And they think, well, he's strange, but at least he's not in trouble. No. So sometimes I think this in different ways. But, you know, our preaching, it should always have some immediate considerations. You know, as we try to do so many things in such external and extensive ways, we don't want to forget what is our immediate environment. This is on part of this tour. I was trying to counsel some of the devotees about, you know, while you're doing so many things for the temple, you are considering, you know, you've been working very nice and very good, but why are you not thinking that taking care, proper care of the wife and your children is not also devotion? Are you considering that that's Maya? Well, that's just something that has to go on, and it's going to go on its own. Sometimes that can happen, especially in, you know, in this presidency. You can be so much managing the temple, managing other people's lives, and not considering that our own situation is the gift given by Krishna also. So I was counseling one older husband and wife couple that as they see that Krishna has given them a child, has given them a husband, or given them a wife, or given them a situation, then they must be attentive in taking care of that, as that is also service. If they're looking at it in that way, that it's given from Krishna. Now, if you're thinking, this is mine, then you're going to impose all of your stuff on in that relationship. That's going to be hellish. Because it just doesn't work that way, smoothly. There's always these extremes. We have so much of the either or. So I either am a griha meti and pursue so much I and mine, or I'm a very good devotee, and I'm a devotee who's a householder, but I'm not being a householder. You know, sometimes someone is a devotee and a householder, and then they are trying to be a brahmachari, a brahmachari in household life, or they're the other extreme, but there must be, of course, healthy balance. Anyway, it's a whole other discussion. But basic point is that we preach by particularly our immediate environments, trying to see how to bring more Krishna out of that environment. Any last question or comments? Yes?
I have a question. Suppose there's someone in your family, like they're attached to an animal. Like, for instance, my sister, she left her job, she moved out into the country, she's living over the stables, she's attached to a horse. And she's just talking about how happy she is and this and that. And I'm, you know, I was trying to talk to her, but unless I'm talking about this particular horse, even send me a picture of her and the horse together. Does that mean that that person comes back as a horse? Or how does your trying to be a devotee help that person? How does it help?
It will happen more and more because of people being disturbed with, you know, human relationships. So more and more people are substituting their love and their connection, you know, with animals. Because the animal they can care for, the animal is not going to, you know, they say be judgmental. They can be free in giving their affection, their care, such. The sister, you say she married?
No.
Does she have children?
No.
Then you see? So if she had children, she would be a little more, she'd lock some of that love into the kids. She had a partner or something. So, this everyone's looking for love. Everyone's needing love, looking for love. And so we find different ways to look for that and to express that. So, preach to her by entering into her space. You know, use the horse thing and help her with it. You know, horse is the most important thing in her life, practically. So if you're going to just try to tear that away, how's there going to be any communication? So then you also become excited about that horse. Try to help her. Yes?
Much like in my case, with my family, is it all right to preach to them to let them know, or advice to wait when parents, you know, heal their wounds or whatever, or will their wounds ever, you know, heal, or is it just going to be wounded and wounded and wounded? And
well, like we chant our rounds, I mean, we chant the 10 offenses, 9 offenses that we should not preach to the faithless. And what does that mean? It means we're always ready to preach and always looking for opportunities to share. But if in sharing, then it makes someone become more disturbed and offensive, then we should back away. Because then instead of helping the person, we'll put them in a situation where they're going to have to pay, you know, more, you know, karmic debt. They're going to be in some debt, you know, for that. So then we back away. But see that, you know, in so much in the earlier times, we would just join the movement, and the parents wouldn't see us, you know, 15 years or something. Or they haven't seen us on Sankirtan, or they hear about us. Or so that can make people angry, you know? And especially, I mean, in a material situation, your parents think that you are owned by them. They see you as an extension of themselves. So the first thing they're thinking is that, I wouldn't do that. So what is he doing? Why is she doing that stuff? Because they're really looking at, you know, they're selfish. You know. But the idea is that this is my creation. And why is my creation doing that kind of stuff? I wouldn't be doing that. So why is she doing it? Why is he doing it? So they become disturbed. And then when you're not reciprocating anyway, then we get really, we become very, very, very disturbed. And of course, some cases it's there because they, you know, they care. But in the majority of cases, you know, they don't want to admit it. They want to admit it so easy. But in the majority of cases, we are all accidents. Very, very few. You know, I mean, now, especially now, nowadays, there's more abortions than live births. And then even with those live births that are existing, so many of them are accidents. And then so many are unwanted. And so it's a product of lust. But still, they want to claim full control. And so they feel disturbed. I mean, there have been cases where, I was hearing some cases in Detroit where, I think even in John Wayne's case, where his father even, you know, gave him books and got him involved in the movement. But then when he joined, oh, that's like, and we have that in South Africa a lot, where, you know, families are, because they're from the Vedic culture, the Indians, and they're, you know, they're appreciative of Krishna consciousness. And they come and they visit, and they give donations, and they do different projects. And so their children, you know, become inspired. And sometimes their kids are excited because it's like an international movement, and, you know, gives them a chance for a lot of association. So often their children will want to join. And they'll be so disturbed. Even sometimes they're initiated. I can see cases where the father and mother are actually initiated. Huh? And then their son or daughter, you know, decides, you know, the kid has been in university or going to university and decides to join. Now, of course, part of that is our own problem. Is that if they could feel that our infrastructure was better, they feel a little more comfortable also with their child joining. In some cases, they're appreciative of the philosophy of the movement, but, you know, they don't want to get that close. Where, you know, to that extent. And so they don't want to get that close. And they don't want to see their children get that close. Because they're a little afraid about what the experience of the child may undergo. In some cases, it's very economic. Because here in America, you know, we have a welfare system, you have pensions, there's so many things that are more established. But in many countries, the future of the husband and wife or the parents is so much locked in with the child later taking care of them. And so if that, you know, child becomes a sadhu, then they're thinking, who's going to take care of me, you know, in my old age? You know, it becomes a serious issue. Any last question?
But in terms of leadership representation, as you're representing our Islam society, one of the things that I've noticed, just amongst the devotees, is that many devotees have a residue of being trained in a very fundamental orthodox way. So, in terms of your representation, can we say that the leadership is changing in terms of their views about how to spread Krishna consciousness? Because the things that you speak about are not how many devotees were trained.
There's the institution. The institution is comprised of individuals. And it says each devotee is different. Even each karmi is different. Even simultaneously, what do you call it? Even twins are different. So leaders are also different. And people have different things that they may emphasize in their preaching that may be different levels of realization and also different missions. Just like even within other traditions, you have various bona fide saints. And so they have a commission to do certain type of work. And so they appear in certain situations. And that's not even Vaishnavas. So amongst the Vaishnava community, the idea is one is working for his guru. And of course, there is always variegatedness. But the idea is to what extent it is pleasing to guru. In other words, the disciples of for instance, were initiated by Srila Prabhupada, and we're all under Prabhupada's care. But whatever we do, the final evaluation of that is based on how much Srila Prabhupada is pleased by it. So whether someone is using their creative intelligence for this, or whether they're following this thing or that thing, whether they're working in this zone or that zone, this project, that project, it all comes down to if Guru and Krishna is pleased. If they're pleased, then whatever happens has more and more blessings, more and more potency, more and more auspicious. And if they're not, then it's just a disturbance, or it will have some sorts of stagnations. And it's each devotee's duty to always try to see how to serve Guru. I mean, that is our philosophy, and that is our nucleus. Now, as we try to serve, we get some basic guidelines that's given, you know, by the acharya. So Prabhupada's given us some basic guidelines, and then it becomes a devotee's duty to see how to be loyal to those guidelines, and to implement it based on the preaching environment. And so that is involves a means of being loyal to what's given, and a means of being compassionate. See, when there's not sufficient compassion, then we will not sufficiently agitate our minds in trying to see how to serve. When there's not sufficient appreciation of what is given, then we'll not be so eager to try to give it up, because we won't appreciate it much ourselves. And when our faith is weak, then we will fall back on so many things instead of the devotion or trying to put purity as foremost. And then even with all of that, everything is all based on how Guru and Krishna sees it. Because I mentioned yesterday, the idea of every devotee is like we're sparrows, we're little birds, huh? We're trying to do something. And if Krishna is pleased, the Guru is pleased, then those little efforts will turn into something grand. And if not, you can stand on your head, hold your breath, you can do so many things, and one will find that we'll just be an exertion of so much energy that we'll not be able to properly produce. That's the difficulty in Krishna consciousness, because somebody can say, well, I'll just chant and I'll be serious, and my guru will be pleased, because I'll chant serious rounds and I'll be serious. Or I will just build so many nice things and sell so many books and hell with everybody because I'm doing the work for my guru. But Krishna consciousness is not in any way a mechanical thing. And it is it is very, very much not even an external thing. But we do so many external things to access proper internal consciousness, because they go together. But it's about consciousness, Krishna consciousness. And so a certain type of consciousness gives a certain type of realization, a certain type of understanding, a certain type of connection. A certain type of consciousness gives something different. I mean, gradually we come to a point that as someone talks, as someone acts, and nobody shouldn't categorize people, but we are soldiers in the sense that we had to always deal with Maya and also with Krishna. in terms of what is proper. But it shouldn't be difficult at some point in our spiritual life that devotion can be evaluated based on a certain level of understanding. It says something about consciousness. Because there is absolute truth, and there is absolute principle, and there's absolute laws, and as that absoluteness is unfolding, then as you come in touch with it, you get certain realizations. Just like, you know, everybody already knows this, when you're doing sankirtan business, certain way the born-again Christian will respond as you approach that person, or as they say something, and you know, it's a born-again Christian. Certain way the really zapped out New Ager responds when they approach Krishna consciousness. Certain way, you know, the voidist or just a gross materialist. Certain things they say, certain things they do. Well, same thing with the voice. You know? Certain type of consciousness produces certain type of understanding, certain types of activities. Just like when Bhakti Siddhanta, now end with this. When Bhakti Siddhanta, some of the disciples heard, you know, we're wanting him to associate with this devotee of Lord Ram. He's this tremendous Ram Bhakta. He's always absorbed in so many ways, speaking and chanting and crying about Lord Ram. Even to the point that at one point he said he couldn't live any longer with the intensity of just being in separation from Lord Ram. And he threw himself in front of a train and his legs were cut off him. Even after that, he still was chanting Lord Ram. So Bhakti Siddhanta's disciples, they took him they probably encouraged him to go, you know, to meet with them. And he inquired about his relationship with Lord Ram. Is it direct or indirect? And he said it was direct. And he told the devotees, let's go. There are certain questions, there are certain things that get at a certain level you can speak with a devotee about and understand where that devotee is coming from. This is not a religion. This is a science of consciousness. And there's a lot of pretense, and there's a lot of mechanicalness, and there's a lot of insensitivities, and there's a lot of knowledge gatherers who are not experiencers, and there's a lot of maya. And because of the maya, because of the lack of some connections, then we turn to sense gratification. Sense gratification has many, many ways how it's manifested. But devotee's duty is simply he wants to serve so the spiritual master is pleased, and spiritual master is pleased, then there will come certain strengths that will be there because Krishna will arrange. By pleasing Guru, then Krishna becomes pleased. And Krishna and Guru, they're not trying to hoard anything, but it's the opposite. So much based on freedom from a false ego, compassion that makes everything more available for Krishna consciousness to settle in and to be taken. Otherwise, like we're reading today, people get very distracted by the whole idea of absolute God. Well, this gentleman I was talking about in the TV program with, so he was so-called spiritualist, he was an academician, there's so much knowledge and so many different things. But then when it came to the point of absolute truth, no way. It can't be. That's simply dogma. Because he wasn't really thinking about the idea of surrendering to a personal God. So it was all dogma to him. That, oh, this is nice. We want to think about religious things. But if you talk about absolute, then you're going to make people who could become spiritual, you're going to fry them out. They're going to run away. So he's still playing the idea of being spiritual and wanting to appease people and afraid that the whole idea there's an absolute God, then it will just turn people off. So let's not think about that. He's not ready to accept it himself. Because his real religion was a science. And the idea of the spiritual thing, that was secondary. So the science then became the primary thing. Everything was ultimately being monitored by that. And where that didn't fit in, then he rejected religion. ISKCON founder child of His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Sri Prabhupada Ki, Sri Sri Radha Dhammadara Ki, Hare Krishna.